From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Welcome to Tuesday's Richie Allen Radio Show. How you doing? Are you in fine, settled, good form and all the rest of it, eh?
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
I'm in good form myself.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, Susan Bradford is an investigative journalist and author, and she was kind enough last week to send me her latest book, which is called Unmasked, and it's about the coronavirus, the origin of the virus, what it is meant to do, in her opinion, and who's really behind the agenda. It's very good, and I'm looking forward to speaking with Susan in the second hour. We'll have a good old chat. Susan Bradford joins me. Before that, though, I'll round up the day's news as best as I can, and you can join me on social media, of course, Twitter and all the rest of it. Yeah, I've been really busy this afternoon. I had a lot to do. You always have a lot to do, but today it felt like there was lots and lots to do. You know, you get bogged down, but anyway, we're on air. All is well. We're on air. We're on the air. And I'm looking forward to your company. It is Bastille Day in France. Don't expect any French from the BBG. Never lived in France and haven't taken up the option of trying to learn the language. Rosetta Stone and that sort of thing. I haven't done it yet. I know a few choice phrases, but that's about the size of it. You heard the details there of Ghislaine Maxwell's arrest, didn't you, on the news? Apparently, silly details emerging that she wrapped her phone in tinfoil to avoid being tracked by the phone pinging off the nearby cell towers. So she wrapped her phone in tinfoil. If that's true, fair enough. If it isn't true, somebody's taken the piss out of us by using tinfoil and phones. There you go. First appearance by video link today, as you heard. Ghislaine, or Ghislaine, as she has been dubbed by wags in the independent media. Ghislaine. She maintains, haven't seen Jeffrey Epstein in over 15 years, and I have had nothing to do with trafficking girls. Yes. Also in the news today is the story of, I think you pronounce it Naya, or Naya Rivera. She was an actress that was famous for being in Glee, which was hugely popular. Glee at one time. I never saw it myself, but it was popular with tweenies, I believe. And I noticed that the media were running pictures today of the cast of Glee standing at the side of the water where Naya Rivera drowned, where she was found. The cast held hands and posed for a photograph. Media moments, eh? We do live in very strange times, don't we? Staged media moments, getting yourself trending on Twitter, the 24-hour media cycle. Forget private grief. Forget grieving away from media intrusion. No, no, get down by the waterside now and hold hands and look somber and get yourself trending on Twitter. Don't waste a good publicity opportunity. These are mad times. Also, multiple news outlets reporting today that a very rare sighting of the bearded vulture in the UK has taken place. That bearded vulture is not Richard Branson sniffing around the arse of Matt Hancock looking to scavenge a few NHS contracts. No, a genuine bearded vulture, which apparently is native to these parts. I didn't know that. There's lots that I don't know, as you will obviously be aware if you tune into this programme regularly. Right, 7 minutes past the hour already. Wearing a face covering in shops and supermarkets in England to become mandatory from the 24th of July. We're not surprised. If you don't comply with the new rules, you could be fined up to £100, according to the government. Matt Hancock, the health secretary, said it would give people more confidence to shop safely and enhance protections for those who work in those shops. This will bring England into line with Scotland and other European countries like Spain, Italy and Germany. Okay, Matt Hancock did address Parliament this afternoon. Would you like to hear him talking about masks and the new rules? Here he is.
Should an individual without an exemption refuse to wear a face covering, a shop can refuse them entry and can call the police if people refuse to comply. The police have formal enforcement powers and can issue a fine. This is in line with how shops would normally manage their customers. And enforcement is, of course, a last resort, and we fully expect the public to comply with these rules as they've done throughout the pandemic.
Yeah, mad stuff. The police are not happy. The police have said, we're not happy, this is a bit mad, we can't police this. I'm sure they'll try. The world is upside down, isn't it? It's topsy-turvy. It's inverted. Mad stuff. Imagine if Constable BBG was working at Salford Police Station. Hello, Constable BBG here. Hi, BBG, it's Tesco's manager. There's a guy here who hasn't got a mask on. Strangely, ordinarily, you would phone us when somebody is wearing a mask inside your shop. God be with the days of common sense and, well, this is mad. These are mad times. Mad times. So it's compulsory from the 24th, that's Friday week, is it? Is it? Is it Friday week? I think so. And the exemptions are for children under 11 and those with certain disabilities. You'll be exempt. I was informed by my local GP, I was this morning, that as somebody who is an asthma sufferer, I won't be expected to wear the mask anywhere. Maybe more on that later on, maybe not. The Mail ran a story today, the Daily Mail, that said a study proves, studies are all the rage in the tabloid media, they have been now for a few years, a study proves those who refuse to wear a mask are of a lower cognitive ability. You're a bit of a thicko if you don't fancy wearing a mask to protect your fellow citizens. But there was some interesting stuff today when Hancock told Parliament about this U-turn. And it was a startling moment when, after Matt Hancock had made his speech, the Shadow Health Secretary, Jonathan Ashworth, responded. And he responded. And this is a bit creepy.
On testing, local authorities still need specific data that can facilitate action. They still need, he disagrees, they still need person identifiable data, not just postcodes. They need not just positive test results, but they need the negative results as well, so they can understand the overall infection prevalence. And they need contact tracing data, so they know who has been asked to isolate by test and trace, so they can follow them up. And they need it daily. The virus doesn't wait a week, so why should local directors of public health have to wait a week?
Wow. That's a Labour Shadow Cabinet Minister asking that local authorities, your local council, effectively, be given data for action, personal identifiable data from your doctors, contract tracing data to follow up on those who are asked to isolate. Public health officers. Your local council wants your medical data, including your name and the Labour Party, where you live, and the Labour Party wants them to have it. What did the Health Secretary say in response?
He asked about data. Patient identifiable data is available to local authorities when they sign a data protection agreement.
Yeah, we're way ahead of you there, Johnny boy. It's already available to local authorities. All they've got to do is promise that they will look after that data. Right.
Of course there has to be a data protection agreement. And as he knows, we plan to publish more and more of this data as open data. So we will continue, Mr. Deputy Speaker, the work to control the virus. We'll continue to bring in measures as they are appropriate.
Yes, we will bring in more measures when we think they are appropriate. So there, we will see your Joseph Stalin and we'll raise him. Astonishing stuff. The BBC reporting right now is that millions of people around the world going back into lockdown. You heard India getting a mention on the news there at the top of the hour. It's not just India. It's elsewhere in the world as well. In Australia and other parts of the world, people getting told, that's it, back into lockdown now. There has been a spike in cases, or a surge in cases. More on that in a few minutes. 12 and a half minutes past the hour, the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford. In the great city of Salford, it must be said. Now, wonderful bit of high comedy on BBC Radio 5 Live this morning, dear listener, about conspiracy theories it was. Because apparently conspiracy theorists are everywhere and they're dangerous. They're dangerous and something needs to be done about them. This was delightful to me. I was out doing my thing with the canines, as I do, and I was flipping around between a few different channels and caught this. Nicky Campbell of BBC Radio 5 Live. You are up, pal.
That's how it happens.
This is 5 Live.
5 Live.
6:51, let's talk conspiracy theories, coronavirus and conspiracy theories. There are lots of them. And Rachel, because we're debunking and poo-pooing conspiracy theories, will be...
We are debunking and poo-pooing conspiracy theories, says Nicky to Rachel, his co-presenter.
So because we're debunking and poo-pooing conspiracy theories, will be...
Is that your job, is it, Nicky, to debunk and to poo-poo conspiracy theories? Wouldn't your job be better and more interesting if you invited some of them on, I don't know, to argue with them? That'd be entertaining radio, wouldn't it? No.
There will be conspiracy theories to say the mere fact that we're doing that means we're part of the whole conspiracy and our superiors have told us to do it, driven by dark forces. But look, I promise you that's not the case.
He promises us it's not the case now, that his production team told him when he came into work today, you're doing a piece on conspiracy theories, Nicky, where we're going to debunk conspiracy theories. That's exactly what happened. It's not a conspiracy, it's how radio works. Arseholes like Nicky Campbell, they're basically just window dressers. They don't have any skills, they don't have any talent. They're given a script by a producer, including questions and talking points. There you are. So you've lied from the get-go, Nicky. Anyway...
Matt Hancock has told the BBC conspiracy theories about... You don't believe me, do you, conspiracy theorists?
No, I don't believe you. Right. What did Matt Hancock then tell the BBC? What did he tell the BBC?
He said that vaccines pose a threat to health.
He what? What did he say? What did Matt Hancock say?
He said that vaccines pose a threat to health.
He said that vaccines pose a threat to health, did he, Nicky? I don't think he said that. I wish he did. Wish he'd be honest about it, but I think you messed it up there. I think you meant that he said that conspiracy theorists opining about vaccines pose a threat to health, Nicky Campbell.
He said that vaccines pose a threat to health, these conspiracy theories. You know, David Icke is leaving.
I think when you're telling lies, I think this is what happens. When you're talking monumental bollocks, it affects your diction, it affects your ability to speak, clearly, as demonstrated there by Nicky. Go on, it's worth another listen.
He said that vaccines pose a threat to health, these conspiracy theories. You know, David Icke is leading the way on this, and you know, they took him off Twitter. No, so they took him off YouTube, I do beg your pardon. So how can you talk about conspiracy theories?
Well, you're not allowed, Nicky. You're not allowed, unless it's under certain conditions. Unless it's to mock and to ridicule and to basically gaslight people. But you're not allowed to discuss if there's any real evidence to support any of the theories, because, well, you'd be fired if you ever had the balls to do that.
You've seen with somebody you know. How can you actually break the conspiracy theory ice? The BBC specialist disinformation reporter...
Hang on. What was that again? What does the BBC have?
Disinformation reporter.
They have a disinformation reporter.
Mariana Spring.
Mariana Spring is a great name. She's a disinformation supporter. No, she isn't. Well, she is. She's a disinformation supporter, but she's also a disinformation reporter. The BBC has their own disinformation reporter. Mariana, you don't have to leave the office, love. Just look around you. Anyway, intrepid young Mariana, the disinfo reporter, took a father who was concerned about Bill Gates, which makes the dad a conspiracy theorist. She took him to an expert for some re-education. Honestly.
So Bill Gates is actually at the heart of it. He's, you know, wants to create these vaccines to kind of control the world or something.
Or something.
Anyway, what's the what are the big concerns about these vaccine conspiracies?
What are the concerns about these vaccine conspiracies? Mariana, intrepid young reporter.
Yeah, that is right about the conspiracies about Bill Gates, which are untrue.
They're untrue, are they? Have you investigated them, love?
But yes, so the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, has told the BBC that essentially vaccine misinformation is incredibly dangerous.
Incredibly dangerous.
That he's concerned about, and it shouldn't be allowed to spread.
Shouldn't be allowed to spread. Keep all this in mind now.
Spread. And we're seeing an increase in coronavirus vaccine conspiracies, often in Facebook groups, ones that focus on conspiracy theories, like that one that suggests 5G is linked to coronavirus, or more specifically about vaccinations. So the suggestion that the coronavirus vaccine is part of a conspiracy to microchip everyone and survey people, and the suggestion that Bill Gates...
To microchip people and to survey people, and you've looked into that, Mariana, have you? So you can dismiss it out of hand as lunacy, as folly, as fanciful. Presumably you've looked into it now.
Is somehow involved in that because he wants to make money or control people. And it's not actually just limited to kind of quirky corners of the internet. We're seeing these vaccine conspiracies spill into local Facebook groups or parent groups. And it's in those spaces that someone you know, maybe your neighbour or your friend or a relative, are coming across them and perhaps being affected by them.
Perhaps being affected by them. It's in these Facebook groups that somebody close to you might come across these discussions about the safety of vaccines and about what Bill Gates is doing, which is well documented, even by the mainstream media. And we have to protect people from coming across that stuff because it's dangerous.
The problem is, it's like when you sit down with young earth creationists or flat earthers, they just do not believe you and they think you're part of the conspiracy by telling. This is the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an incredibly difficult area to address and to tackle, which was why we decided to try and do that. I started thinking about this.
She's very earnest. So she thought, as I said, she'd bring a bloke who's worried about Bill Gates to a professor. I think this is where it's going.
I'm thinking about this when I received an email from a member of the audience, a guy called Simon. He's a dad of three from Shropshire, and he got in touch with me about one of these conspiracies, one about Bill Gates, suggesting that Bill Gates owns the patent for a coronavirus vaccine, and therefore he is using this whole thing to make loads and loads of money, and perhaps it's more sinister and he might have been involved in its creation.
Okay, so the father of three young boys was worried about the fact that Gates might have a patent on a coronavirus strain, and that's a bit worrying and a bit concerning that there might be a bit of a conflict of interest there with Gates and the vaccines. Father is a bit of a conspiracy theorist, so we have to deal with that and re-educate him.
All of those claims are untrue, and they kind of take...
Hang on, did you just say all of those claims are untrue? I think she did, you know.
This whole thing to make loads and loads of money, and perhaps it's more sinister and he might have been involved in its creation. All of those claims are untrue.
All of those claims are untrue, okay.
They kind of take individual facts that are correct and throw them together to create something that's incorrect.
All right, so they take individual facts that are correct and throw them together to make something that's incorrect. Would you mind enlightening us on which facts are correct, and we could discuss those exclusively maybe, no?
And in the email, Simon said to me, if you actually address these conspiracy theories that are based in fact, then maybe people would listen to what you had to say.
Right. So off we go to the professor.
So I decided to kind of get Simon to come to London and to meet with a professor, a guy called Jovan Byford, who specialises in conspiracy theories.
How do you do that exactly? Specialise in conspiracy theories.
Conspiracy theories, what makes them so appealing and popular is that they are very often based on small kernels of truth. So
they're based on small kernels of truth.
So, yes, a coronavirus has been patented.
It's been patented, right?
Yes, by the institution that you mentioned. Yes, Bill Gates funded that institution.
Yeah, by the institution that you mentioned. It's not that he funds it, he vicariously owns it. He owns the institution.
But what very often happens is that these kernels...
What do you mean, but? Hang on a second. The father contacted the BBC because he was concerned that Gates was up to his neck in owning patents of coronavirus, in using various institutions to promote vaccines that he's going to benefit from financially at the very least. And the professor is basically saying, yeah, these are actually kernels of truth, but you know...
Ivan Byford, who specialises in...
Listen to this again, it's absolutely extraordinary.
Theories. And
conspiracy theories, what makes them so appealing and popular is that they are very often based on small kernels of truth.
Right.
So, yes, a coronavirus has been patented.
It has?
Patented. Yes, by the institution that you mentioned. Yes, Bill Gates funded that institution. But what very often happens is that these kernels of truth at some point lead to what the American historian Richard Hofstadter called the leap from the undeniable to the unbelievable.
The leap from the undeniable to the unbelievable, right.
And during the course of this conversation, there was...
They just confirmed everything the father of the three kids believed. This is mad stuff, this.
Top tips, really, about how to have a productive...
Top tips on how to have a productive conversation with a conspiracy theorist.
Productive, constructive conversation about conspiracy theories with someone you know who's entertaining them. The first thing, it was to establish a basis of understanding, to actually define what is a conspiracy theory, what are we talking about. Then it was about avoiding dismissals, just saying you're wrong, but actually listening to what their concerns were, presenting facts and research, and trying to get to the bottom of the legitimate concern that's often at the heart of the conspiracy, why someone's turned to it.
So, in other words, patronise the bejesus out of somebody. Right. This is crazy stuff, this. I couldn't believe my ears when I was out walking this AM.
Did he reflect on this, Anna?
Yes. Yes, he did, actually. At the end, there was quite a nice bit of reflection, which I think we've got a clip of.
Oh, good.
I think that it might make me think twice, but to me, I will always be open to the idea that there's more than just what you're being told.
Thank you very much. That's really interesting and really important, Mariana Spring. Thing is, you know, it's like with conspiracy theorists nailing jelly to a wall. But all these
Nailing jelly to a wall, dealing with a conspiracy theorist.
Conspiracy theories, Rachel, they are predicated on thinking that the powers that be are competent.
Yes, and fantastically efficient at what they do.
Yes.
Let's talk about birds. We like to do that on this programme.
Well, of course, that would be true if Boris Johnson, Donald Trump, David Cameron, Tony Blair were the actual powers that be. But that's not the case. This is the old, they're totally incompetent defence. You get this from those who rush online to try and debunk various conspiracy theories. They often fall back on, well, conspiracy theorists... First of all, start out believing that the politicians are competent. Now, those of us who have been researching this stuff for years, we've moved way beyond accepting that the aforementioned politicians ever really ran or controlled anything. Do you understand? That was on the BBC this morning. I thought you might find that interesting. But they're all at it. And I'm going to give you another bit of James O'Brien, this time from his show Today on LBC. I don't want to annoy you or upset you, but it's important this because of where this is leading. And it's leading very rapidly to the shutting down of any discussion of these things, like vaccine safety, like what Bill Gates is doing in academia and in the corporate world, and what he's doing at the World Health Organization. And how he's basically pulling the strings of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world. They don't want people to talk about those things because of where those discussions lead. Now, I say this not to be alarmist, but we know, those of us who... There are one or two people are close to this radio programme. They're quick with a kind word and a bit of advice. This programme will not exist in 2 years in its current form. It won't be allowed. This is where this is going, you see. Even a relatively moderate, mild approach like mine, which is to bring people on and to challenge them and to disagree with them and to do the old mainstream job, there's no room for it because of where they're taking this world, you see. So right now, in the midst of all of this, you must wear masks and you will not be allowed to... go back to the world that you knew until we have a vaccine. While that's happening, there's a massive assault on free speech going on. And it's far more sinister than a few right-wing people getting kicked off Twitter or David getting kicked off of Facebook. It's far more sinister than that. They're coming for everything. It will be illegitimate. It will be bad social behaviour in the immediate future to be caught discussing conspiracy theories. Listen to James O'Brien on Radio LBC Radio this morning.
That both MMR and climate science denial began not in the outer reaches of the internet. It's tempting sometimes to think that the current madness is all linked to Facebook algorithms and dodgy Russian missions and various other manipulations. But long before social media sought to attribute equal value to your wrong opinions and my fact-based evidence, long before...
I mean, you're listening to that, right? And this is not off O'Brien's, off the top of his head. This has been handed to O'Brien to read. Well, to rewrite in his own words and then read. Astonishing. This is the denial of balance and the denial of other opinions agenda. They have lamented now for about 2 years that they are still obliged, at least technically, by Ofcom, the broadcast media regulatory body, they are still obliged to find, to give room to every side of the story. But they're kicking off about that now, increasingly. And the regulatory body is turning a blind eye. They're basically saying, why should I have to give any room to your nonsense? If I declare it to be wrong and baseless, why should I have to provide a space for it on my radio programme? Right? Do you see where we're going with this?
Equal value to your wrong opinions and my fact-based evidence.
This wanker is an LSE graduate. If he's a journalist, so is Wurzel Gummidge. He hasn't got a brain in his head. Horribly destroyed in very... I suppose, high conflict in very aggressive interviews with Jacob Rees-Mogg and Nigel Farage. If you have half a brain, you'll annihilate O'Brien because he's fairly thick and his face gets red and he doesn't do well when he's being challenged. But this is the crux of it now. There are wrong opinions. They shouldn't be given any airtime. If I have anything to do with it.
Long before it turned everything upside down, these two issues from which, for my money, so much stems. I've told you this before. I'm not going to apologise for repeating myself because it's fair to say that the lessons of MMR vaccines and climate science denial have not yet been fully learned, and we're seeing them being reprised now.
The lessons of climate change denial. We can leave MMR to one side, the measles, mumps and rubella jab, which I believe is unsafe. I believe there is an abundance of evidence that the MMR jab is not only unsafe, but it's unnecessary. But I'm not going to get into that now. But climate denial. We've not learned the lessons. The lessons are we've got to prevent any discussion of it because it's settled. Man-made climate change is ruining the world and that's the bloody end of it. And we shouldn't allow anybody to speak about it. Not on this show, but not even on Facebook. Not anywhere. We've got to shut it down, and we've got to shut it down quick.
In an almost identical fashion to what went before, we are seeing reputable organs, publishing people, almost all...
Now he's criticising newspapers like The Telegraph and The Daily Mail and The Independent to a lesser extent that do strive, at least, to get a conservative voice on those issues when they get the opportunity. And they shouldn't be doing that.
Almost all elderly men claiming that face coverings are... I mean, I thought yesterday when people told me that the word muzzles had entered common parlance.
Yeah, we'll leave O'Brien. I won't subject you to any more of that. Essentially, what O'Brien goes on to say is that something needs to be done about those who would give a platform to older white men, he means conservative MPs, who challenge the necessity of wearing face masks. Now, I said yesterday, I won't say it again, there is an abundance of evidence to show that face masks are not only fairly worthless in protecting you and protecting the people in front of you, but they're also potentially harmful to those who wear them. And this dickhead knows this. No, don't swear again. But O'Brien is a stooge. He's a puppet. He ain't a journalist. He ain't a broadcaster. He is a means to an end. And his program and his radio station, which is owned by Global Media, is a means to an end. It is not there, ironically, to lead Britain's conversation, because LBC stands for Leading Britain's Conversation. You could choke on the fucking irony. It is there to present the establishment version of events at the expense of all others. And it's rotten. It's 28 minutes to the top of the hour. Let's leave coronavirus briefly, because you're getting fed up with it. I know you are. And we'll be talking about it in hour two. Let's leave it briefly and talk about this. Rape has been decriminalised effectively as a result of a collapse in prosecutions that has allowed many offenders to escape justice. And this is according to the Victims Commissioner for England and Wales. She's given her very first annual report since taking up the role. Her name is Dame Vera Baird, QC. She said there's been a catastrophic decline in rape prosecutions with no measures put in place to reverse it. And she endorsed criticisms that were raised by campaigners against sexual violence. She said, in effect, we're witnessing the decriminalisation of rape, and in doing so, we are failing to give justice to thousands of complainants. That's very important, that's very serious, and we'll come back to that specific subject in the coming weeks. We will, because there are women who want to come on this programme to talk about it, and we will do that. But while she was on Sky News this afternoon talking about the decriminalisation of rape, the presenter, Jane Secker, wanted to ask her about trans women working at rape crisis centres. Trans women, that is men who identify as women, working inside rape crisis centres. Is that true? You will hear the presenter first.
Over the weekend, there was some pieces in the paper about a number of rape crisis centres that were that come under the spotlight because they were putting out a documentation saying how trans-inclusive they were and that they were looking for self-identifying trans women to join their helpline team. Now these are people who believe that they've been born into the wrong body but haven't undergone any medical treatments or anything yet. Does that raise any red flags for you as someone who's worked with women and victims, female victims of violence for a long time?
I must say, it doesn't immediately raise red flags with me, not put as you have put it. If anybody is sexually assaulted, however they identify sexually, then they need to get justice. And they are, you know, no more likely than people who have not got a trans disposition to get it, I'm afraid.
I'm referring to the fact that women who've been raped going to the rape crisis centres could find that actually they are being counselled by somebody who was born a man. Does that not concern you?
Yes, I would find that very difficult to follow because I think that there is a need for a social gender commonality between people in that particular situation, which would go beyond what was able to be given them by that person counselling them. However, I do not have any problem at all with people choosing their sexual identity, but there is at the same time a need to make sure that everybody is comfortable with whom they are talking to and whom they can discuss the most intimate things with. And so those are balancing factors that really have to be taken into account. But look, I don't want to get too far away from the fact that the criminal justice system is a problem right now.
Yeah, the decriminalisation of rape, she shuts it down basically. And you could hear pretty obviously in that little clip there how terrified people are of criticising or appearing to be criticising the transgender lobby and mermaids and these people. Extraordinary, really. It's ridiculous that men who identify as women would be working in rape crisis centres as counsellors. It's insane. And this came about, as you heard the presenter saying at the very outset of that little clip, that some rape crisis centres are taking the side of those who want to self-identify quickly and basically endorsing them and saying, yeah, we're happy for you to be here and to work here if the occasion arises. Terrifying. I mean, this is mad stuff, isn't it? In rape crisis centres. I used to interview a woman many, many, many moons ago. My presenter did. And I did once or twice as well. Called Sheila Vericker. A great lady from Waterford City. I don't know where Sheila is these days. But she ran the rape crisis centre in Waterford. And I can't imagine what she'd be thinking about this now, you know. Crazy. And they're scared to death of saying anything. Because of cancel culture. I suppose Vera Baird imagines that if she speaks out against trans people working in outside these rape crisis centres, or even going to a rape crisis centre where there are women, that she might end up losing that position that she's just recently been appointed to. Yes, 22 minutes to the top of the hour. Here's an interesting one for you, and it's on the care system. The government, as you will know because this was announced on Monday, has set out plans for how the immigration system will work after the Brexit transition ends, which is due to end on New Year's Day, right? And they've got a new fast-track visa route for healthcare workers, but it doesn't include social care staff. And that's pissed off a lot of people. There's been a lot of discussion of it. So it includes healthcare workers, nurses, doctors and so on, but not social care staff. People who care for people when they can't take care of themselves. Okay? The elderly generally, but also people with various disabilities. And you know how it goes. Right, so Kay Bardy got into this on Sky News this morning, and I just want to just... This has been bugging me. Let's hear Burley's intro and the beginning of the interview.
There have been warnings in recent days of a black hole in the care system, with some groups saying highly skilled workers in the care sector are being overlooked by the government's new points-based immigration system that doesn't recognise their skills. Joined by Vic Rayner. He's the chief exec of the National Care Forum. Hello to you. Thanks for joining us on the programme, Vic. Forgive me. 100,000 jobs is what the gap is already, vacancies. How much worse is this going to get?
So at the moment, as you rightly say, we've got 122,000 vacancies within the care sector. Those the care sector is made up of approximately 1.6 billion, million workers, indeed. About 18% of those, 17 to 18% of those are non-British, so non-UK citizens. So clearly, if we are going to turn off the tap of that supply from both EU and non-EU countries, then we're going to increase that shortfall very significantly, very quickly, because not only do we have a shortfall, but it's also a sector which has a high level of turnover within it.
Why do you think that the government hasn't included care sector workers in this points-based system?
I mean, I think it is... We've got a very kind of... It feels like a very arbitrary system that is based on a salary point rather than a recognition of skills, despite itself talking about wanting to bring the best skills and talents into the UK. So what we have within the care sector... is a position that's very challenging. It is a low paid sector, but it's absolutely not a low skilled sector. And what we need that points-based system to do is to recognise those skills that people are bringing in. And at the same time, we need to be fighting hard to increase those pay and terms and conditions of those working within the sector.
We must really, when I say we, I don't mean we. It's the royal we. We must really despise our senior citizens, to put them mostly in the hands of people who earn under £18,000 a year. Eh? How low do you have to place people in the pecking order of a society that when they need a bit of assistance more than anything, you send them people whom are probably worried to death about their own finances, about their rent, about their mortgage, about their children's schooling. That's what they're getting. The average salary is just under £18,000 a year. The people who care for our grandparents and our elderly parents whom we can't care for because they've got late stage dementia or other very serious problems are earning a pittance. Meaning that it's basically unaffordable for UK citizens to do that job. Meaning increasingly carers come from overseas. Increasingly. Now, the majority of carers are still British. Not going to exaggerate the point, but that's changing. And I mentioned, this is important to me, this, because I've talked about this many times before. I meet a woman sometimes when I'm out walking my dogs, a woman called Anne, who's from Yorkshire. Nice woman. And she disagreed with me in general on carers coming from overseas to be problematic. She said, a good wage is no guarantee of a good carer. There's a good point in that. You know, if you gave people if you gave people £22,000 a year or £26,000 a year or a proper living wage, it's no guarantee that they'll be any nicer a person or any more compassionate. Now, she said that her mum was cared for by non-UK nationals and that she, the daughter, found them to be very compassionate and said they took pride in the job. But she did agree that her mother had real communication problems when her dementia meant that her condition deteriorated. Her mum had difficulty understanding the overseas workers and vice versa. I think Jean Anne Crowley said to me one time, familiarity breeds contempt. So why not, if you've got tens of thousands of kids every year leaving school, if the job is very skilled and very important, which it is, why wouldn't you train them properly? I don't think you can dismiss the notion that if you give somebody a proper wage that they'll take their job more seriously. And if they're not coming to work stressed to hell with worries about finances, that they might be in a better condition to do the job they're doing and be more patient and more understanding. Extraordinary. Does Burley get into the low wages thing, does she, and conditions as a barrier to UK nationals? Of course she doesn't. She wants to talk about clapping for carers.
Yeah, it's a bit of a slap in the face, though, isn't it? You know, clapping for carers every Thursday night and now saying, actually, you can't come in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there will be people across the country who are working.
Yeah. And now you can't come in, says Burley. Burley couldn't make the leap. Oh, you clap for carers, but now you're telling carers you can't come into the country. What about people in this country that need employment? None of the media will touch that. None of the media will touch it. It is 16 minutes to the top of the hour. Back to coronavirus briefly when I come back after this. Good to be with you. The Richie Allen Radio Show. Live on Tuesday, the 14th of July, Bastille Day, obviously in France. Don't forget, Susan Bradford joins the programme. She's checked in. I'm glad of that. And her book, Unmasked, we'll be discussing that a bit later as well.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbajerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
You're Richie Allen Show, live from Salford. A dull and grey afternoon, but it's quite warm. It's a bit muggy out there. Right, back to coronavirus then. Got to rush through this because it is important and I want to do it. Back to the virus, I'm afraid. Hey, listen, you might be aware of this, but one of the bigger stories, or one of the most covered stories today, is the claim that the UK might see around 120,000 new coronavirus deaths. That's 120,000 coronavirus deaths in the winter if we get a second spike, right? Now, I'm going to turn off the scary music. It's not even funny, this. This is deadly serious. They're saying all day long that if there is a second wave, and they're bringing experts on to say that it's not if, it's pretty much when, that 120,000 people could die over the winter. So they're suggesting that because of that, everybody in the country needs to get the flu jab, whether they like it or not. Right. What's that got to do with coronavirus, you might ask? They claim that the NHS doesn't need the problems arising out of a flu epidemic on top of the second wave of coronavirus. Yeah. And they're calling this a reasonable worst-case scenario, 120,000 deaths. And it's everywhere today. Second wave. And incredibly, Sky News has been reporting from Italy, from a hospital there. And they have been claiming, Sky has, that coronavirus is unlike anything that has ever been seen before. Why? Well, because many of those who get over coronavirus don't actually get over it. It leaves them with life-changing health problems. And the effects of the virus can be with people for years and years and years. Now, this is astonishing, this, because it is not backed up by any evidence whatsoever. They admit this. It is hearsay. Pure hearsay. This is not evidence-based. They're claiming that this virus, unlike any other, well, not unlike any other, but not like any other respiratory infection, can leave you with terrible health conditions for years after you've had it. And I caught this last night on Sky News. I'm so glad I did. Sky's science correspondent, Thomas Moore, you will hear him explaining this. Before you hear Thomas Moore, you will hear the tail end of the Sky reporter from the Italian hospital. So before you hear Moore, you'll hear the very end of the report from the Italian hospital.
The long-term effects of the virus on society is ongoing. A second wave remains a possibility, but the effects of the first wave go on.
Stuart Ramsay. The effects of the first wave go on, long-term effects, second wave, right, fear porn. So Sky have got a guy in the studio called Thomas Moore who's going to explain this.
Sky News, Lombardy.
So the doctors of Lombardy are clear COVID-19 has chilling long-term health consequences for some of those who catch it.
Imagine that. The doctors of Lombardy. Now, I had to look up Lombardy. I knew it was in Italy, geography not being my strongest subject. You didn't know the region of Lombardy, a big bald... Listen. There's only so much intelligence a man can have, and I'm obviously a genius. But geography is not my strongest suit. Doctors in Lombardy said, long-term, life-changing consequences. So it must be true then. Let's hear from Thomas Moore.
Catch it. And as our science correspondent Thomas Moore explains, that assessment is shared by researchers worldwide.
This is bullshit.
It was our report from Bergamo at the beginning of Italy's epidemic that brought home the horror of COVID-19. Now we're seeing firsthand the terrible lingering effects of the virus.
Horror. Terrible lingering effects.
Effects of the virus. Almost 13 million people around the world have so far tested positive for the coronavirus. COVID-19 was originally seen as just a respiratory disease. For most, it is the serious breathing problems that results in their admission to hospital. But one in five or six people are left with damage to their lungs that leaves them breathless and coughing months later.
How can he say that? There has been no study. They haven't had time to do a study because they've been battling or combating the so-called disease. This is disgusting, this. This is hearsay. This is not a peer-reviewed paper in the Lancet Journal. This is just horseshit. Fed to journalists by a few doctors in Lombardy and then claimed to be backed by doctors around the world.
Originally seen as just a respiratory disease. For most, it is the serious breathing problems that results in their admission to hospital. But one in five or six people are left with damage to their lungs that leaves them breathless and coughing months later.
What are we going to do about these people? Something is going to have to be done because this is not going to get any better. What are we going to do about this? These lies. I could have been a second day radio producer. And I was at one time a second day on the job radio producer. And I would know that this is horse manure. This is garbage. Imagine the irony. You've got Nicky Campbell on BBC Radio 5 Live this morning talking about the danger of conspiracy theorists, mums and dads, worry about whether vaccines are safe or not. And you've got fuckers like him lying through his teeth. Lies that have real-world consequences for every one of us.
Just those who needed a ventilator who are at risk of scarring to their delicate lung tissue, and there's no cure. Now, as the pandemic has unfolded, doctors have realised COVID-19 has an impact on other body organs. The kidney is affected early on in the disease. A third of people in hospital with the virus develop moderate or severe damage to their kidneys with...
How do you know?
...with some needing dialysis.
How do you know?
Or even possibly in the longer term, even a transplant.
Just making it up. A third of those treated need a dialysis. Some of them will need a transplant. How do you know?
The heart...
He's making it up. So he moves on to the heart then.
Heart is also at risk. Studies in Italy and China show one in five people suffer some kind of damage. They can have symptoms similar to a heart attack in the early stages. In the longer term, the heart muscle seems to weaken with an impact on its ability to pump blood. Even the brain, normally shielded from viruses, is susceptible. It seems around half of those with COVID-19...
Around half?
COVID-19 have some neurological effects.
This is disgusting, this.
Symptoms can be mild. Headaches, loss of smell and tingling sensations. But they can be much worse. Strokes, seizures and the inability...
Strokes and seizures.
So... Why?
What are we going to do about these people?
Why does the disease have such a broad impact on the body? It could be because lots of different cell types have the ACE2 receptor on their surface. It's the doorway into the cell that the virus uses to invade and make copies of itself. Or it could be the immune system itself that sometimes goes into overdrive to kill the virus, but sometimes causing catastrophic collateral damage to healthy tissue. Scientists just don't know the full impact of the coronavirus. In Britain, researchers will track 10,000 people who've been discharged from hospital.
What was that last bit there? After 2.5 minutes of pure, undiluted bullshit, what did he just say there?
But sometimes causing catastrophic collateral damage to healthy tissue.
Yeah.
Scientists just don't know the full impact of the coronavirus.
Scientists just don't know the full impact of the coronavirus. But I've just spent 2 minutes telling you that 5 people out of 10 or 1 person out of 5 or 6 will have serious neurological problems and people are on dialysis and they'll have to have kidney transplants. But really the truth is scientists don't have a Scooby-Doo. Eh?
Sometimes goes into overdrive to kill the virus, but sometimes causing catastrophic collateral damage to healthy tissue. Scientists just don't know the full impact of the coronavirus. In Britain, researchers will track 10,000 people who've been discharged from hospital for up to 25 years.
Yeah. 25 years tracking to be done on 10,000 coronavirus survivors. Wow.
Is to see what happens next. And with such a new and unpredictable virus, there are bound to be surprises.
Bound to be surprises, says Thomas Moore. What did the Romans do with public figures when they were found to be corrupt? Corrupted. And as usual, and I mean it when I say it, violence, threats, abuse on social media is not the answer. It's not the answer I'm looking for. You don't go around threatening people. You don't go around hitting people. What are we going to do about these people? Because it's that fucking horse shit, right? That is responsible for people you see in supermarkets and on buses and on the tube and on trams absolutely terrified of the proximity of other people. It's this unchallenged garbage dressed up as journalism, dressed up as news by a television channel that, like its counterpart, BBC 24 Hour News, BBC 24, is on everywhere now. Pubs, supermarkets, gyms, constantly on, pumping out this crap to people who swallow it. They ingest it and they digest it and it deeply affects them. Have you ever heard anything like that in all your life? I haven't. And I've been doing what I've been doing with a little break here and there for the best part of 22 years now. Shall we have a tune and set our guest up? I think we should. Welcome to the Richie Allen Radio Show. It is Tuesday. It is July the 14th. I am the BBG. This is certainly not the BBC. And this is Paul and Jarvis Cocker from Sheffield. What a tune this is. Back in a couple of minutes. Pulp on the Richie Allen Radio Show, Tuesday's programme, Drive Time here in the UK. Not many cars on the road these days, eh? Not as many as you'd expect Tuesday afternoon at this time, but anyway, I'm delighted that my guest reached out to the programme. We should have reached out to her, to be fair, some time ago. She's a very respected investigative journalist and author, and written some fascinating books, to be honest, and I'm going to start reading them. She was kind enough to send me a copy of her latest book, which is very prescient. It came out in May, and it's called Unmasked, and it's about the genesis of the coronavirus, the powers behind the coronavirus, what the virus is meant to do in terms of how it's meant to transform the way we live, and so much more besides. I'm about 100 pages in, and it's a terrific read thus far. Like I said, we should have had her on the programme in the past because of you know, the great work that she's done. And I was listening back to interviews with her on other programmes over the weekend. So I'm delighted to welcome to the show the one and only Susan Bradford. Susan, thanks for taking the time to speak to us today. How are you?
Oh, hi, Richie. I'm doing very well. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me today. It's a great honour.
No, the honour is mine. I mean it. And thanks for the advance copy of the book. I don't often or always get a copy of the book, sometimes still after we've had a chance to talk. So I'm really glad that I did. And we're going to go to the top of the hour, so we've got plenty to talk about. I don't endorse very much, but I am endorsing Susan's book. I'm enjoying it. It's very good. It's very well put together. And I do recommend it. And I will put a link out to Susan's website on Twitter as well. Before we talk about the book, Susan, somebody of your experience, can you believe the world that we recognise now, the one that we live in, this paradigm? Did you foresee this? Did you see anything like this ever materialising?
To be honest, I never did. I met Baron Robert Rothschild in the late 1990s, and when I was working for the Atlantic Council, and he had told me, you know, he said, our vision for the world is a dictatorship. And I had no idea that he had any chance of bringing it about. I thought that he was a bit of a megalomaniac. But sure enough, you know, we are seeing the brave new world unfold before us. I never would have imagined.
Wow. Tell us about that meeting with him, this Rothschild character. How did that come about? Was it a work assignment? Was it social?
He was very active in the Atlantic Council and also the European Atlantic Group, which was geared towards establishing a common market between North America and the European Union. And I had, at the time, I was working as editor of the European Review, which was a departmental publication for the Center for European Studies at Essex University, where I was pursuing my master's degree. And I invited him, requested an interview with him to discuss the European Union. He kindly obliged, and I was able to interview him at his house about his vision for the European Union.
Wow. And he laid it out. You thought that he was a megalomaniac, that he was reaching, maybe bragging about global domination, but he wasn't, obviously. He meant it.
He did mean it. I'd also met John Vanderlip, who's the son of Frank Vanderlip, who founded the Federal Reserve with Rockefeller, and he had also suggested that their plan was for a dictatorship. And I honestly, you know, I dismissed, you know, their plans. I didn't think that they could ever, you know, bring them about.
Wow. But now here we are in 2020, in July. Mm-hmm. We're being told in the UK that from next week we must wear masks or be fined £100. Cities are being re-locked down all over the world today. It makes perfect sense what you heard those years ago. Susan, like I said, I'm going to say again, Unmasked, I recommend the book. It's really well put together. I love your style of writing, and I love the fact that you leave things open-ended. You're objective, and I think it's a rare approach in the independent media today. I really do. Susan's website is susanbradford.org. We're talking about her book, Unmasked. You're certain, as much as you can be, Susan, that the virus is not a naturally occurring one, that it has the hallmarks of something that's been deliberately created.
Yes, I am. And now, just to give you some background on this, The virus, the coronavirus, along with its vaccine, was patented by the Purbright Institute in London in 2018. The Purbright, you know, the sponsors of Purbright are the Wellcome Foundation, you know, which has worked with Purbright throughout the years to develop vaccinations as a weapon of war. They are also funded by DARPA, you know, which works on new military technology, the World Health Organization, the Gates Foundation. So they had this planned out years in advance. But there's always the possibility that this could have, you know, been leaked by accident or maybe maliciously in China. But if you look back at the events that occurred, the first occurrence of the coronavirus took place, I think it was in October or November of last year, in Wuhan, China. It occurred at the military war games, which brought together the, representatives of armed forces throughout the world who competed in sports activities. And this event was very significant for a number of reasons. One is that the elites hope that a communist China will be the leader of the New World Order. And also the event was sponsored by the International Military Sports Council, which was working with the International Committee of Military Medicine, the WHO, and the International Pharmacy Federation. And these groups were they've coordinated the armed forces and healthcare workers around the...
We've just lost Susan momentarily. Bad connection there. Apologies for that. It's trying to reconnect there. It's a poor connection. I hope we can get her back. If not, we'll take some music and we'll fix it. You're back, Susan. You're back in the room. No, we've lost Susan. Tell you what we'll do. We'll disconnect. I'll disconnect and I'll reconnect very quickly and see does that make any difference. What a shame. This is very interesting. Susan Bradford speaking about her brand new book, Unmasked, which was published in May and is available on all good and all bad websites, online websites, Amazon, the usual one, susanbradford.org. And I can't reconnect to her momentarily. What a shame that is. So we'll have to take a tune, I think, while we do that. Yeah, we'll take a tune. Apologies for this. It can't be helped. There's some Chris Isaak, bizarrely. Chris Isaak. I don't know why. It isn't very upbeat as far as tunes go, but here you go anyway. Here he is, Chris Isaak. And Wicked Game, and hopefully we'll get Susan back ASAP. Wow. Right, Chris Isaak, Wicked Game. We lost the connection with Susan on Skype there. No worries. Things happen on live radio. I think we've reconnected, Susan, on the old dog and bone, as they say in London. We're back.
This is true.
We're back.
Thank you so much.
Not at all. Look, thank God you've got a brain and you sent me your backup numbers and everything, which is good. So we'll do it this way, and it's a lovely line anyway, so I'm glad we can reconnect. You were talking there about the military games, October 2019, and you mentioned something that fascinated me about the elite's desire to create this new world order with communist China kind of at the epicenter of it, and that's where we lost contact with you.
Yes, thank you so much. Communist China is their vision, you know, for it's like, you know, they're trying to create a new world order with communist China at the helm, and there are a few different agendas that they were trying to accomplish with this with the coronavirus vaccine. One is that they are becoming aware that there are more dissidents, more are patriots and nationalists who are waking up to their agenda. So they were hoping to be able to somehow identify those people and maybe kind of squash dissent by imposing more tyrannical controls. We're also looking at, you know, as you've seen as well, an economic bubble that is on the verge of popping. So they're having to provide some type of cover or justification for their economic bubble. And in addition, they've come to realize that they want more revenue, but they know that the public is tired of war. They cannot get public support for war. At the same time, they bankrupted the healthcare industry. I know that they have it in the United States through the Obamacare and like socialized medicine. So with the the coronavirus vaccine, they were able to apply military technology through a global company called Kinetech, in which the Queen of England holds the golden shares. And they were able to apply the military technology that they had developed through Kinetech to the vaccines that were also, and the virus that was developed within England, and impose tighter controls and also generate revenue for the healthcare industry, you know, through pharmaceuticals and other, you know, medical services, products and services.
Tell me more about this company that the Crown or the Queen is involved in. Because when I was reading this in the book, I was fascinated. A number of different credible journalists like yourself, you know, ones that are experienced investigative journalists, have been talking to me in recent months about the Crown Corporation and the Queen, the City of London, and how kind of all pervasive they are. So what's the name of this company again? And can you just let our listeners know how we know for sure that the Crown holds the lion's share of the stock?
Okay. The firm is called Kinetech. It begins and ends with a Q, which implies that the power within the company begins and ends with the Queen. If you look through their paperwork, you will see that that the Queen does in fact hold the golden share. It's called the golden share, and only she can hold that. Then that gives her a controlling interest within the company. Kinetech has acquired American patents, has stolen quite a few of them, allegedly, through a company called Serco. Serco processes a patent from America through to Britain. The Queen also holds a golden share within Serco. So they have all of this like military technology that, and they have received contracts for the RFID chip, thermal imaging, FEMA camps. They were, you know, partnered with the Carlyle Group, which is one of the most, you know, infamous revolving doors between government and private practice.
Yeah, government and the military industrial complex. So many ex-prime ministers and ex-presidents, of course, end up going into groups like the Carlyle Group. And I was glad to read in your book that you'd been looking into Serco. That's a very sinister company in the UK, Serco, which provides public services. A lot of people in this country will be, you know, startled to hear of the Crown's involvement in all of this, because they think control, Susan, they think the major banks, the central banks that create money. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Rockefellers, Rothschilds, the Oppenheimers. So where do these big creators of money and the banks that control the Federal Reserve, what do we know about their relationship to the Crown and the Queen?
Okay, let me think about how to phrase this. I guess after World War II, plans were laid out on how the elites could coalesce the wealth and power throughout the world within their own hands. They established a public-private partnerships in which the government would provide funding and advantages to build up these great multinationals that ultimately became too big to fail. These companies owed their allegiance not to a country, but to their shareholders. They were sponsored and developed in concert with the Federal Reserve, which controlled the money supply. So they were able to create the conditions, you know, that were favorable to these companies. They could create the conditions to collapse the, you know, economies and take out money through Wall Street bailouts. And this agenda really started in the late 1800s through the Round Group, in which British aristocrats and the monarchy were trying to figure out how to rebuild, I guess, the British Empire throughout the world. And so the Queen and the monarchy was at the top of that empire. She was advised by the Rothschilds and other international bankers, who in turn created the financial system, controlled the monetary system throughout the world through central banks and through public-private partnerships. And then the corporations in turn would benefit you know, if they went along with the agenda. Yeah, and of course, the elites control them through interlocking boards of directors.
Great stuff. This is great work, Susan. The Roundtable Group, of course, is basically, it's a secret society. We know now the various arms of the Roundtable Group, of course. The Council on Foreign Relations, of course, being one, and so on, so on. And everything you've said there is true. To this day, they claim that it's nonsensical conspiracy theory, but it isn't. It's a fact. And anybody who does a basic bit of research, all this information is online. And before we talk about, we come back to the modern day and we talk about this fear the elites have that people are beginning, you know, to mobilise against them, which I hope, I sincerely hope you're right. Before we come back, I really do, more than anything. I mean, these are terrible times and I just see it getting worse. You're certain, are you? You're certain that if this is a pyramid thing with different layers, at the top, you believe, is the crown, is the queen?
Yes, I do. I mean, at the same time, you know, she is in a way a victim herself. She's controlled by, you know, by the bankers. But yes, she is at the pinnacle of the pyramid.
Yeah, a lot of people agree with you. A lot of very learned and people who've been researching for many years agree with that. Susan Bradford is our guest. The book is Unmasked. It came out in May, and I'm recommending it if you need. It's a book that you can read. It's very well put together, very well written, very easy to follow and understand, and very engaging, which again is not always the case in the independent media. But Susan's a real journalist, a real writer. SusanBradford.org. Funny you mentioned these corporations. There's a story that's linked to what you were talking about. You know, corporations taking over from governments, corporations taking control of public life. What about this story about the Washington Redskins? You've got some of the biggest corporations in the world, like Amazon and Coca-Cola, now telling a company, a football team, if you don't change your name, we'll basically ruin you financially by withdrawing our sponsorship and support from the stadium. It's incredible to think that is going on, right, Susan?
Yes, it is terrible. And of course, like, the irony in all of this is that the British settlers were actually had a very amicable relationship with the Native Americans. The British Crown, through the private bankers and the robber barons, were the ones who are trying to kill the American natives with blankets laced with smallpox, and they militarized them and tried to use them against the early colonists to forge war, which the Rothschilds would then finance to generate debt, which would enable the crown and the Rothschilds to control our economy. So they are responsible for a lot of the elite, the global elite, are responsible for a lot of the animosity between the races. And I believe that with the issue, the controversy surrounding the Redskins, that they're trying to usurp what they perceive to be the power of the white American. The white Americans are simply the people who built that society. They would have the same animosity towards the Chinese or the French or any nationalist who they perceived as being a threat to their own will for power. Like, they're using the natives as window dressing. And these groups like Google and Facebook and so on, if you were to do some research into their background, you'll see that they emerged from the military-industrial complex through these different intelligence communities through the NSA, and that they were essentially created and are agents of the Crown, so that they enable the Crown to kind of work through them to kind of push their agenda and to create the illusion that they're independent companies trying to change and enlighten society.
Yeah, and Facebook is obviously now, Susan, a huge Trojan horse, isn't it? It was obviously designed to get everybody there. You know, to get us all into this one particular space, cyberspace. And once everybody was there, it was going to be very easy then to control what people see, right? And what they hear.
I think that's true. They were able to control what you could see, and then gather information on your own life, your contacts, and try to manipulate you into thinking and taking actions that they wanted.
And is that why we're seeing now such an emphasis on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram seemingly being told that they must deal with hate speech and they must deal with conspiracy theories? So Mark Zuckerberg, on the one hand, looks like, or he tries to look like, to appear like he's on the side of the people and free speech. But in reality, there's something else going on, I think. What do you think?
I think you're right, Richie. I don't know Mark Zuckerberg, but I have heard that he is trying to make a stand for free speech. I do believe that he is a Trojan horse. And also, you know, a lot of these tech companies are looking for the market share in China, which they stand to profit far more than they would in the U.S. or Great Britain. So I think they hold their ultimate allegiance to China. China, in turn, can dictate their policies. And of course, China has an interest in undermining our society and weakening us from within through, through race baiting.
And yet you take a very balanced approach to China in the book. And this is one of the reasons I really like the book, Susan. You've got a very objective approach. You know, you're a real journalist. I'm going to say that again and again and again. There aren't too many of us left. But no, you are. I mean, I'm not a writer like you. You're a gifted writer. But you take a balanced approach to China. I mean, even you discuss what Mike Pompeo has tried to do to China. You know, you talk about what Fauci was doing in China. So it's not all bad as far as what China has been doing, at least as far as you can see.
It isn't. And I know that China has been victimized by these elites, just as we have been. And currently they're trying to forge a Belt and Road Initiative, which I'm sure you're aware of, with Russia,
yeah,
to create an alternative international world order that would contrast or be separate from the corrupt Rothschild control system. So they're trying to actually break away from it. And I actually found an interesting bit of information that I wanted to share with you. There's a law firm that has an office in London called Austin Sidley, and they are representing a company called the Paxos Trust that is developing the first cryptocurrency that would be redeemable in gold. And as you know, the Rothschilds they determine the price of gold in London through their exchanges.
Yeah.
So this appears to be an effort by the Rothschilds to again try to create a new global financial system through cryptocurrency.
There's so many things arising out of the virus, Susan. You know, obviously, cashless society is a massive problem for any patriotic person, for any person who understands what freedom is. I should have the right. If I live near you, Susan, and I want to buy your lawnmower for $60 because it's not working so well anymore and I can fix it up, I should be able to do that and give you $60. But if things keep going the way they're going, we won't be able to do that. Cashless society, and they're using the coronavirus, aren't they, as more of an excuse to bring it in.
They definitely are. And our Eric Schmidt, who was the former CEO of Google, is working with Jared Kushner at the White House to develop a vaccine that has a type of chip within it. Eric Schmidt had actually designed the social control system within China that allows the Chinese Communist Party to withdraw or to withhold the ability of Chinese citizens to, you know, to use their electronic cash system if they in any way, you know,
is this, you know, social credit?
Communist Party.
Sorry to interrupt you, Susan.
It's social credit.
Now tell me, this is good now. Right. So you won't mind me saying this because you're a journalist. Eric Schmidt was involved in helping the Communist Party in China begin this social crediting. That's news to me. How do we know that to be true?
There are articles which I can even send you the links to that. There are articles that confirm that.
And you are satisfied. I mean, you are as experienced a woman as I've had on the program. You are satisfied that those stories are true, that he was involved.
I do believe so. I hope, you know, I do believe so. I'd be happy to, you know, pull up those articles again, but I do believe that is correct. He also created Project Nightingale. He was behind Project Nightingale, and that was a trial system run by Google in which they tried to collect the personal data of patients for data sharing. And our federal government has created a new law that data sharing is okay if it's done within the interest of national security. And a national security threat could be, as they've written in their own documentation, an ideologically motivated non-state actor. And that could be a person whose ideology or belief system they do not approve of. And that would then constitute a threat.
Mad.
But
wow. And, you know, I've just dragged up an article by Daniel Nelson on science trends going back about two and a half years ago. And it basically endorses what you just told me of Schmidt's involvement in it, in this whole system of social crediting. Isn't it funny? And guys like me, you know, I've been talking about what China is doing and I've been warning that it's coming here. Well, it was always meant to be here by the looks of it, by what you've told me and by what I'm learning now. It was always meant to come here, that China is basically the test case for it.
Yes, that's correct. And China was the state where they developed these new technologies and control system, and it was intended to be the template that they wanted to impose on the West and the rest of the world. But what they're finding is that Americans and Europeans are more individualistic, and they're actually resisting these efforts. I think it's to their credit.
Well, we know about it. This is the thing, and there's an air of optimism running through you today and through the book, basically. That people are going, we've got Susan Bradford on, Unmasked is the book. It's about the genesis of coronavirus, the powers behind releasing the virus, what they want to achieve with it, where it all goes unless we do something about it, the key players. It's a really, really important read. I recommend you check it out. Go to any of the big online retailers. Go to Susan's website, susanbradford.org. Because, yeah, we're talking about it now. We can see how they might bring it in. You know, they're talking about compliance all the time. You know, we don't need to get the police to find people, said our Health Secretary, Matt Hancock. People will comply because it's the right thing to do. It's the socially acceptable thing to do. I mean, it's obviously going to be 18 months, 2 years down the line. I mean, they're even talking about a passport now, aren't they, Susan, where you might have to be able, you might need to demonstrate that you've had the forthcoming coronavirus vaccine. And if you can't demonstrate that, your powers to, I don't know, go for a beer or go to the cinema, those might be taken away from you because you've not had the vaccine. That is social crediting, yes. Effectively.
Yes, that is correct. And they will say that you don't necessarily have to have that passport, but then if you don't have the passport with the chip that can follow you where you go, you will not, as you said, you will not be able to go for the beer, you know, go shopping, you know, take your kids to school. You know, your freedom will be severely limited.
And the freedom of your children and everybody else.
Freedom of your children.
Astonishing. And one of the big concerns a lot of my listeners have is that younger folks, and I hate to be patronising, I'm only 45, I'm not that old, but younger folks,
you're
because
young man, so.
We're about the same age. We'd say we're about the same age, Susan. But they're people younger than us, the generation behind us, they are wedded to their devices. And the fear is that they will think that this is a pretty natural evolution. Yeah, why not if somebody is behaving badly and doesn't do their bit for climate change and doesn't stand up for gay and lesbian people and doesn't, you know, and I have no problems with anybody, gay, lesbian or otherwise, but they seem to be more accepting of it, I think.
I think you're right. They're already, you know, they've adopted a form of transhumanism because they've allowed that device, like their smartphone, to be attached to them at all times, at all days.
Yeah.
And if you've noticed that they've also tried to, they've approached the children through online gaming, where there's already a growing online cyber commercial system whereby a young person can purchase items for a game in order to progress to the next level by making purchases online for virtual products, like, you know, like a knife, for example, that might enable them to defeat a monster to get to the next level. So it's already being incorporated into them.
It's already
into their system.
Yeah, and I've had experts on education on recently telling us about how education is being increasingly corporatized and pushed online, isolating children from one another. That's a big thing. A lot of listeners, we've had an enormous reaction to this on Twitter, by the way, so far. Ironically, I know, but people are sending their comments and messages on Twitter, listening to this with great interest. SusanBradford.org. Susan is our guest. Let's talk then about the big elephant in the conversation. Let's talk about the man who's sitting in the White House, who my listeners have won't be surprised to hear that I don't have any time for. I have less time for the woman he defeated in 2016 and her husband, Bill Clinton. I have no time for any of them, Obama or otherwise. But you deal with Trump, again, very objectively in the book. You look at him from several different angles. And you even talk about Q And I'm not going to say it. I don't want, because the book is good and I don't want to be giving away bits of the book. But you talk about Q. What, give us your gut feeling then on this guy, Trump. Is there any legit, you mentioned earlier on Kushner and his influence on the White House, and of course Kushner's friendships with Bibi Netanyahu. You talk about Netanyahu, of course, in the book, and you know the part he's played in this agenda very well. It's an excellent book, Susan. So let's talk about Trump then. To me, he's just another puppet. They're all the same. But you see him a bit more of a nuanced character.
I had a lot of hope in Trump initially. Because he did do some things that were positive. So, for example, he tried to help the United States become energy independent. And the reason why that's so valuable is if we're able to become less dependent on foreign oil, we can become more independent within ourselves and kind of withdraw from the corrupt global system. He also made some efforts to control the borders. And he did support people in their efforts to to embrace their spirituality, their faith, and more of a sense of personal morality that the elites had tried to eradicate. But at the end of the day, and unfortunately, I do think that he's proven to be a swamp creature. He has packed his administration with neoconservatives, and I know that a lot of people tend to say, well, he doesn't know what Jared Kushner may be the mastermind behind a lot of these damaging policies that we're seeing. But he appointed Jared, and surely he knows what he is doing. So I do think that he appointed Rothschild, Wilbur Ross, who was a Rothschild banker. I think that at the end of the day, Trump is pushing the agenda along, but he did give us a slight reprieve. And I think another positive was that he, through his actions, through his brazenness, if you will. He was able to get a number of the swamp creatures to reveal themselves and for the media to reveal itself as, to be essentially propagandists. There are some positives.
Is there one example of that that stands out whereby he was able to kind of inadvertently expose, some other swamp creatures? Because a lot of his supporters, I had one of his loudest supporters on the programme last night, a conservative talk show host called Larry Gators. He's a very nice guy, Larry. And Larry's and a very smart guy. He's convinced that Trump is genuine and that he's fighting this, supernatural battle deep embedded behind enemy lines. And I don't believe that. But because I'm speaking to a man who's intelligent, sometimes I have a moment of pause. So is there any examples where, because many of my listeners do like Trump, even though I'm an old lefty, from years ago. They do like him. And they do believe that he's tried to dig down into the underbelly of pedophilia. Is there any truth to any of that?
That's a very good question. I know that allegedly a lot of pedophiles have been exposed on his watch, but I'm inclined to think that the patriots who've been exposing the pedophilia network actually came from England prior to his inauguration. I think David Icke and others helped expose the pedophile network, and you did as well in the Jimmy Savile case and others. And they were the ones who began to push to expose the pedophilia, understanding that the pedophile network was the glue that held all of these corrupt elites together. So if you were able to expose the network, you can bring down the cabal and eventually, sweep them out of power. I do believe that Trump kind of rode that wave. He may have supported it somewhat, at least in his speech, but I think his actions tend not to always correspond with what he's telling the public. I think he's trying to encourage us, but I think, he's more interested, in my view, in shoring up his own financial empire, maybe building, Trump Towers in China, ultimately.
Yeah, and I think it's maybe a little bit. I think that's a brilliant point, Susan. And I've tried to be as objective as I can around Trump because from day one, when he began his campaign, I've been looking at these various parties and politicians for years, and I concluded a long time ago that the House always wins. So long as we put our faith in the two-party system, ultimately the House doesn't care which one we vote. We could put a German Shepherd dog in the White House, and they wouldn't care because they'd be holding the lead. SusanBradford.com. But no, you do objectively deal with Trump in the book. And for Trump, supporters, she does take a broader view of Trump and who he is in the book. which is unmasked, by the way, and I'm 100 pages into it, and it's very, very well put together. Tell us about this your opinions as an experienced journalist, the saga of Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. How do you feel about that? We hear that she goes for her first appearance today via video link. There are concerns for her safety. Mm-hmm. People believe that Jeffrey Epstein was murdered in jail. Indeed, a coroner was hired by the family of Jeffrey Epstein, and he said that he believes he was murdered. Was Epstein a big player in keeping politicians honest, in blackmailing people to do the will of the cabal, or is that too simplistic? What do you think, Susan?
That's a very good question, Richie. I remember, I think it was during either the first or second Bush administrations that the Washington Post had exposed a pedophile network that was blackmailing our politicians. So this has been going on a long time. I believe it's connected to the Mossad. In terms of Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine, I don't really know too much about, you know, whether they killed themselves or what, you know, what their role was beyond, you know, what I read in the newspapers. But I do know that they were, from my own like research, they were tied into some of the shenanigans that were taking place within Florida. And Florida was ground zero of the Abramoff investigation, which in which Jack Abramoff was set up for wrongful prosecution through another Mueller-driven probe. And I saw a number of these characters, Kevin Spacey, Alan Dershowitz, and others who are kind of tied into the Epstein network or kind of were making their appearance. So I do think that there's a lot more there that still needs to come out.
Yeah. And of course, the question is, will it ever come out? Will Ghislaine get to, I don't mean to be flippant about it. I mean, we joke about things we shouldn't really joke about. But, you know, there are a lot of clever people who believe that she'll never tell anything, really. You know, she'll either do a deal or something will happen to her. Her lawyers are saying she needs to be bonded out of prison because they're worried she might get coronavirus in there and then might, you know, obviously get complications because of that. But I don't know. But interesting, that whole thing of Epstein and blackmailing people. Because I suppose my ultimate opinion would be is that nobody gets to the White House or to number 10 Downing Street unless those who really pull the strings have got enough collateral, I suppose, you know, against them to make sure that they do what they're told, Susan.
That's correct. And they are all, for the most part, controlled one way or the other. If they're not controlled, they're pushed out. And there are many, you know, methods of control. One way is through legalized bribery, which is known as, you know, campaign contributions. They will also, you know, the Mossad and other shadow intelligence agencies, which are working on behalf of multinationals and these shadowy global interests, will also use blackmail. You know, they'll try to entice our leaders into compromising situations and then use that as a control system. So they are motivated both by fear and by incentive, you know, in order to carry out the will, you know, of the shadow elite.
Brilliant in the book when you talk about the Russian generals and officers, many of them very experienced men, distinguished men, I suppose, people like Vladimir Kavachkov, and their belief, and I think you found it that it is their genuine belief that there is a strategic group working behind the scenes that wants to reduce the world's population. Right at the heart of the Russian establishment, there are men who believe this. The question that begs to be asked, Susan, is what, if anything, are they likely to try and do about it?
That's a very good question, and I know your audience may not appreciate hearing this, but I do believe that the Russians are our friends, and by friends I mean the friends of the nationalists and concerned patriots. If you recall, the Russians endured their own Bolshevik Revolution in the early 1900s, and the Bolshevik Revolution devastated their country, their economy. That resulted in the murders of tens of millions of people. And it was funded by Wall Street, you know, which included these, you know, private bankers and, you know, the Rothschilds, Rockefellers, and so on. The Russians, through decades of resistance, were able to purge their Bolsheviks from their country. In turn, Kissinger opened the door for them to be allowed into the international establishment. So we now have the Bolsheviks are controlling the United States. I'm assuming that they could very well do in England as well. And so the Russians know that if these Bolsheviks are left unchecked, they know what they could potentially do. There were plans, at least as of a few decades ago, to engage in a global nuclear war. Their view is if they can't have the world, if they can't conquer the world, then nobody else can have it either. They hold no value to life. They want all of the wealth, the natural resources, all of the privileges in the world while giving and investing nothing, giving nothing back and investing very little in the countries, you know, that they rule over. So the Russians are very much aware of them, and to the best of my knowledge, they are working behind the scenes to kind of thwart their plans. If you've noticed,
can I just jump in there, Susan? Sorry to jump in there, but sure. I've got to mention what you say about Vladimir Kavachkov is right, and it's true, and it's great research, great work that you've done there. But on the other side of that, the Russians seem to have, at least, you know, in as far as we can see in Moscow, through RT News, of course, they seem to have embraced the lockdowns and locking people up and telling people to wear masks. And I don't mean locking people up, asking people to stay at home and all that. So on the one hand, you've got Russian senior military strategists saying this is a fraud, a hoax, effectively. But on the other hand, the Russian state itself has gone into lockstep, if I can say that, with most of the rest of the world. Why do you feel that is?
That's a very good question. You know, I think, you know, as much as they've tried to kind of purge the satanic element from their government, I'm sure that there are some holdovers. The Russians have their own oligarchs who are doing business throughout the world. But I think also, given that we know that the coronavirus is essentially a military weapon that is being used against the people, the Russians are the target of the elites because they are resisting their agenda. So I think it's more probable that the coronavirus in its truest form, you know, could be released, you know, throughout Russia. It's possible that they are taking precautions.
Wow. It's a good answer. It's a fair answer. Yeah. I mean, look, I've been very grateful for Russia's intervention in Syria as somebody who, like yourself, you know, and it's true having people like you on. By the way, I must not correct you, but I must say earlier on, I don't get any credit whatsoever for talking about Jimmy Savile and Edward Heath even. David Icke, in his genius, to his absolute credit, over the years has written amazing books on these subjects and put himself out there. All I ever did was interview guys like David and others. So I don't deserve any credit for exposing any of that. I never did expose that. But thanks for the kind words anyway, for what you said, Susan, earlier on. So talking about Russia, and I'm very grateful for what Russia's done in Syria. We know, don't we, there was an agreement made at the end, the so-called end of the Cold War, that Gorbachev was sold a bag of lies, wasn't he, by Reagan and then by George H.W. Bush, that the United States would basically leave them alone. But since then, the US, with the assistance of its allies, have been surrounding Russia with military bases. Surrounding it.
I think, you know, as we delve back into history, we'll see that much of what we were told was based upon lies. The West did not win the Cold War. We lost it. You know, Russia, once they had purged their Bolsheviks, they had no intention on pursuing war against us. They're not militaristic as such. Whereas the Bolsheviks, who are now in our government, wanted to, you know, exterminate them. So when the Berlin Wall fell, you notice that communism just kind of dissipated all throughout Europe because they had no interest in maintaining it. So in the ensuing months after, you know, Ronald Reagan announced that communism as an ideology had been defeated, it continued its march through all of our institutions. And now, you know, we're looking at what we have today.
It's a great irony that so many people can't get their heads around. And you talk there about the lies. I remember doing some research some years ago about Donald Rumsfeld. And as far back as the Gerald Ford administration, I think it was the Ford, maybe it was Carter, but I think it was more likely Ford, Rumsfeld, in his first incarnation as defense secretary, made a very famous speech, which was a pack of lies about they've been busy. He said the Soviets have been busy. They've been building up their military. They've been doing this, and they weren't doing anything. They were doing nothing of the sort. It's the same liars telling the same lies, you know, and if it's not the same liars, it's their children or their nephews or nieces, the same people, right?
That's correct. And there's so much money, like billions upon billions of dollars to be made through defense contracts. And of course, these elites would fund both sides of the war. They would have contract. They would provide weaponry to both sides. And, you know, they profit from war. Whereas, you know, the people, you know, we lose our lives, our economies. You know, we're the ones who suffer for it, whereas they become richer and more powerful.
They get richer and more powerful. We are joined this hour by Susan Bradford, susanbradford.org. A very respected and very successful investigative journalist and author. Her new book, Unmasked, deals with all of this. So it's not just about coronavirus. It broadens out the people behind the virus. As Susan understands herself, it's her work and her opinion, her research, and where it goes, this spider web, and who it connects to. And if people don't start taking it seriously, I worry, Susan, that if we don't start taking it seriously, that there might be a point at which there is no chance of return. And we don't do alarmism here. I know you don't do it either. But we might be approaching that point if we don't kind of wake up to it.
You know, I think you're right. And that has always been a concern of mine, that, you know, we could reach the point of no return. But I think much as, you know, David Icke has also said repeatedly that much of their control system is based in the perception they have of control. So if we're able to acquire an understanding of the truth, how they impose their control system, we will be taking our power back. And once that happens, they'll have less opportunity to impose it. And I think as a number of members of the public and public servants like Robert Kennedy have exposed the fraud behind the coronavirus and vaccinations, they've had to kind of scale back their efforts. You know, so I think given that there has been a lot of pushback from the public, you know, they in turn have had to push back. And I think, you know, we as people need to continue to bring the information forward to educate and empower ourselves. Yeah, and eventually, you know, hopefully, you know, God willing, you'll take back our countries.
I like to think there's more people like you out there, because you come, you know, I mean, your background has been in, I mean, I could read your resume out. It's very, very impressive. But you've done the MSM thing. You know, you've had your byline in what we would call, you know, mainstream publications. And yet you've had the courage over the years to step out through your books and through your interviews to say, well, look, I've seen another side of it. And I just hope there are more very capable men and women who've, you know, been in kind of on the inside of the media, who will have the courage to step outside it and realise that it's their grandchildren and their children that they're leaving the world to, that you've got to speak up about it. You know, I hear BBC presenters sometimes, not often, but sometimes, and I hear a tone of voice. I hear a tone in their voice that tells me they're tired of it. They don't want to be reading the autocue, that they'd rather say something else or do something else. And I think more people need to have that courage, Susan.
I agree, Rich. You know, I have heard, I think, I can't remember which, was it Cuomo, who's the host of CNN? I think he said at one point that, you know, he was tired of just spouting, you know, propaganda all day. He actually wanted to report more truthfully. I don't know how far he went with his, you know, with that goal. But I think, you know, as you said, you know, we can't only think about ourselves and our immediate self-interest. There is a very, you know, a tyrannical agenda that is being imposed upon us. Aldous Huxley and others have laid it out in Brave New World and so forth. There is ample evidence of what they are trying to do. And we need to think in terms of our future generations. What kind of world do we want to leave behind for our children, for our grandchildren? And do we want them to live in freedom, or do we want them to live in tyranny? And I think once you have that realization, you know, I think hopefully there will be a lot of people who will stand up and have the courage to stand up for what's right and, you know, to act accordingly.
Folks, I recommend that you do pick up a copy of Unmasked by our guest today, Susan Bradford. The book can be got, as I said, most online retailers, the main one, you know, the one I'm talking about. And you can go to Susan's website, susanbradford.org. I've really enjoyed having you on, Susan. Thanks again for sending the book to me last week to give me a chance to read it. I'm glad that you did. And I hope you'll come back. And don't wait to be asked back, by the way. Anytime you want to come back on, just give us a shout and we'll always make time for you. I really appreciate that.
Oh, thank you so much, Richie, for having me. And we'll talk soon then.
Look forward to it, Susan. Thanks so much. That was the brilliant Susan Bradford. Check out Unmasked. Her new book, it was published only a few weeks ago. And it's been very well reviewed, as I said, online. And I've been reading it and I found it very, very helpful, very valuable. So susanbradford.org. And I hope Susan will come back on the programme again in the near future. Great to have her on the programme today. And she's old school, belt and braces. Gave me about four different numbers in the event the Skype went down. I always ask for numbers, you see. But often they don't give me numbers. I say, give us a number now just in case something happens to Skype. Yeah, yeah, I'll forward you that number. And then they don't. And then they don't. But old school, yeah, Unmasked. Right, it's 7 minutes to the top of the hour. Let me just have a quick look at Sky and the BBC. See, is there anything happening? Is there anything going on? Anything that happened since we came on air? UK economy rebounds more slowly than expected. Yes, could have gotten into that in the monologue in the first hour. Could have gotten into the devastating economic news that we woke up to this morning. What this lockdown in terms of shutting the economy down through closing businesses, what it will mean going forward. It's devastating. It's devastating, and it's not through stupidity. It isn't. The vast, vast majority of people, of course, are not stupid. It's because they have their fingers in their ears. They don't want to know that, for many of them, when the furlough thing ends, they actually won't have a job to go back to. Because the company will have to pay back the furlough money, borrowed at interest by the government, right? Remember the furlough scheme? The government says, we will pay you, the business owner, 80% of your staff's salaries. We will give them 80% of their salary to tide you through the lockdown. It's got to be paid back. And of course, in the meantime, the business isn't earning any money, any moolah, any spondulics, any cash. The business might have just been ticking over anyway, just wiping its face every month, which is not a bad thing. Doesn't mean that by wiping its face every month that it's teetering on the edge. It was just doing enough to pay the owner or owners and their staff. Now it's fucked. It's fucked now. So people have got their fingers in their ears. You don't want to know. Meet one or two people in the park. I am not very dogmatic as a rule. I've learned not to be. And one or two people will know about the programme. Many of them won't. We'll get chatting about it. Oh, they don't want to know. The minute you say, the economy's stupid, they don't want to know. Don't care. Don't tell me. Yeah, but you won't have a job, or if it's not you, it'll be the person standing next to you. They won't have money to pay your benefits and to give you enough at a subsistence level, because they'll be bankrupt. They'll be telling you they're bankrupt. They're saying now, oh, don't worry about talking about austerity. Listen, that's talk for another day. Don't mention it now. It's too early to mention it. And when you have massive financial collapses, you see a great or a greater than usual transfer of real wealth to the scum in the less than 0.0001% land and all the rest of it. This is how it goes. So there you are. On that cheery note, I think we'll call it a day today. Big shout out again to Susan Bradford. Loved having her on the programme. The book is Unmasked. Thanks to her. It's a Tuesday, so you won't believe it, but Natalie Stacey is about to begin her metal show on triggerwarning.tv. Lovely person. Loves metal. And making an increasingly more listenable programme. No experience. Threw her hat into the ring, as it were, but very listenable. And lovely person, Natalie Stacey, live on triggerwarning.tv repeated on Sundays with The Metal Show coming up in around about 4 minutes' time. I'll be with you tomorrow, as usual, at 5 o'clock UK time. Until then, you look after yourselves and one another. We heard a little bit of Chris Isaak's Wicked Game. Let's hear it all. Let's close out with the whole song, because it's a good song. See you tomorrow. Bye.